I call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is February 29th, 2024. Happy birthday to people who are turning 12 or whatever. There was a first multiple four I could think of. A quorum is present. The first item on the agenda is the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of February 22nd, 2024? All right. Representative Scott moves the minutes of February 22nd, 2024. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. The minutes are approved. We do have a full agenda today, so Ella here will be setting a timer. We did let folks know who signed up ahead of time that they did have a limited amount of time. This is just so we could fit as many people in as possible. So first up, I've got Representative Frederick. Representative Frederick, would you like to move to recommend that House File 4021 be placed on the General Register?
So moved.
All right. And then I understand you have an A3 amendment. Would you like to get to the A3 amendment to get it in the shape you would like?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Frederick moves the A3. Any discussion to the A3? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Frederick, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to be pretty brief in my bill introductions, as I think that there's not a lot of super exciting things in this bill because it is much more of technical corrections than anything else. I would encourage people to jump to page 4, line 17, where we're simply talking about getting rid of language that says blind, deaf, or other person, or sorry, blind, deaf, or other, and then physical or sensory disability. We're just simply saying we're eliminating those categories to make it clear, and doing a lot of other pretty basic work like that. And I would just say the testifiers here can probably go into detail easy too.
Yeah, no complaints about sticking to the point. First up, I have Commissioner Lucero. Can't remember, is this your first time in our committee this year?
Yeah.
Yeah, welcome. All right. Please state your name and then go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Rebecca Lucero. I'm the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. And I think we were expecting a walkthrough of the bill. I'm happy to do so if you'd prefer, but
whoever wants to take it. Commissioner, if you're able to, I think that might be the easiest.
All right, let's go ahead and start with line 1.12 then. This section here is the public policy section that's noting that each of us have multiple complex identities and discrimination can impact on the basis of multiple identities. So this is just noting that. This is already the work that is done. If you want to move next to line 2.10, this is around ensuring episodic disabilities are covered under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The way the definition of disabilities is drafted, it means that some disabilities are not currently covered under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. A really good example of this is someone who has cancer that is currently in remission. You can be in remission from cancer and still your body is recovering from the horrors of cancer, or you might need to go back and get additional care. The way it was drafted, that would not be covered. Another example is something like epilepsy or diabetes. So even when it's treated, there could be flare-ups. Really think like type 1 diabetes, where you could be totally treated and then you could be passed out and really need care. So this would allow for a conversation between you and your employer around what a reasonable accommodation might look like, and it's just expanding that definition to cover those episodic or moments where somebody's in remission and would need to have those kind of covers. If you move to line 2.17, you'll see that we're just updating the definition of discriminate because, of course, you can be harassed in all types of protected class statuses, not just under sex or sexual harassment, and that just needs to be clarified. Under line 2.2, you'll see update for familial status, and this is also in the author's amendment, some clarifying language there. So really, this is about centering the lived experience of children. Domiciled is a really weird word here. Domiciled is a word that, for instance, under the statute, we look at oftentimes for where somebody lives, like the state that somebody is in. That's not what is intended here. And under family law, the questions are oftentimes permanent or legal custody, guardianship, and those are not always the same thing and not always even where a child lives. So this is making sure that it's covering really what is the reality in family law versus kind of a strange domicile reference. The second thing it's doing is it's adding an inclusive sentence here about familial status, means the conditioner for individuals that are 18 or older who have a disability but continue to live at home. So you can think of a good example of somebody who is 17 years old and is covered but because under familial status but then turns 18 and may not be covered but is still needs care by their family. And so this would cover them under familial status. There's a couple lines, including line 3.3, that removes references to the MDHR board. There is no state board for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. It's leftover language from 1955, and there's never been one. So we're just cleaning that up. Line 3.12 clarifies the exclusivity clause in the MHRA. The purpose of this section is to make it clear that you cannot take your human rights claim both to district court and through the Department of Human Rights at the exact same time. If you want to go to the district court, you can do so, but you can't go to the Department of Human Rights at the same time. This is clarifying, of course, though, that if you have a claim under, for instance, the Whistleblower Act and a claim under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, you're able to bring both claims. Line 3.16 cleans up, I think, a little bit of confusion around publication of case accounts to make it clear that, of course, the commissioner can publish a case once it's been resolved and makes sure that, just noting that, of course, all of the rules under confidentiality still exist. I think it's going to be line 3.22, you'll see a change to the 90 days to standardize the necessary deadlines to file both at the state and federal level, and that also will be reflected in line 6.18 for 90 days, from 45 to 90 days for court actions by private parties as well. Under line 4.14, you'll see extending protections from credit discrimination to include familial status. This is in alignment with how, for instance, the Fair Housing Act does it as well, to protect any discrimination based on familial status in credit situations. In 4.17, you'll note that this is cleaning up what is already covered under the law. So importantly, right now, someone who has a service animal for any reason is able to take their service animal into public places under 3638.11, which is covered there. However, under 3638.19, this is providing some confusing language. This is leftover, I think, confusing language from when it was originally written, where disabilities were really seen first and foremost as physical impairments. A lot of community members rely on service animals for things like detecting seizures or mobility assistance, et cetera. So this clarifies and is very transparent to folks where you can use your service animals. Line 5.2 is getting at ADR or mediation, which is a program that we use quite a bit in our agency, and it's noted there. This is providing some additional clarity about making sure the parties are bound by the code of ethics for ADR neutrals and how this program plays out. So it's already noted there. We're just clarifying, providing some additional information. Lines 5.11, clarifying determinations may be heard by administrative law judge. This was a very fascinating one for me because a case can be heard both in district court, and you can see that in 3638.33, which says that a party may bring a civil action directly to district court, or it could go through the administrative law judge process, which is here in 0.29. But for some reason in 0.29, it says shall be heard by the administrative law judge. So those two things can't be true. So it may be heard in both in one or the other place, district court or administrative law judge. So that needed to be clarified. So we are changing that to May. If you go to line 5.24, this is pretty extensive change here. If you look at it, what this whole section was saying was, I think if you take a step back, two things. It's first and foremost is saying, hey, there's a statute of limitations. And if a case is not complex, then after 180 days, charging party would have the opportunity to go to administrative law judge. However, as the OLA noted in its 2020 findings or report, all cases really are quite complex, and so it doesn't work the way that this part of the statute intended it to work. And so we, and the OLA recommended that legislators eliminate the distinction between complex and non-complex cases so that the Department of Human Rights would be free to prioritize its investigation based on the merits of the cases and what's established in law. So that's what this is doing. It's eliminating that distinction and continuing to keep the most important parts here, which is the tolling provisions and the statute of limitations. And then the last thing that I'll note here is, starts at line 7.5, is around remedies or the remedies section there. And again, you'll note the under 0.29, that's the administrative law judge section. That's where all the remedies were for the Human Rights Act. And of course, courts had already said that's where the remedies are. So we're not saying these are new remedies. These already were the remedies that existed. It was just completely absent from the district court section. So we're clarifying and bringing those over to where they should be under the district court section as well, which is 0.33. This change also clarifies that compensatory damages include mental anguish and points punitive damages to Min Stat 549.2, which stresses that punitive damages should be allowed in civil actions only upon clear and convincing evidence that the acts of the defendant show deliberate disregard for the rights or safety of others. And so now that section is appropriately placed in the district court section, and you'll note there's, as part of the author's amendment, sections that eliminate the reference over to 0.29. And that is the bill.
All right, great. Anyone from the public wishing to testify on the bill in its current state? I know we had people who signed up to testify on an amendment, but if there are people who would like to testify on the bill, now would be your chance. All right, not seeing any, we will move on to, we did have a pre-filed amendment from Representative Niska, the A2. Representative Niska, would you like to move your amendment and then tell us about your amendment?
Certainly, Chair Becker Finn. So the A2 amendment is written in order to really get back to the balance that the Minnesota Human Rights Act was written to strike to maximize both the goals of anti-discrimination and the goals of religious freedom and pluralism. Both of those goals touch fundamental human rights and fit within the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And to balance those goals where they might conflict, the legislature passed robust religious exemptions, especially in 326.26. And before last year, when the term gender identity was considered part of or subsumed within the MHRA's definition of sexual orientation, the reference in those religious exemptions to sexual orientation covered broadly claims that included gender identity as well. But when we changed that last year to have a new separate definition of gender identity, there was no corresponding language in the religious exemption that was added to make clear that we as a state respect the fact that religious organizations might have diverse views about questions related to gender identity that we accept as part of their religious exercise and important in our respect for religious pluralism. I've also introduced this. When I first heard about this from faith groups after the session ended, I assumed it was an oversight. I assumed it was an issue that the department, the majority, the administration would quickly agree to fix in order to restore the status quo as it respects religion from 1993 until 2023. But that fix was missing in the department's bill, which is this bill we're looking at today. And that's why, at the request of Minnesota's faith community, I'm bringing the A2 amendment. I also brought this language as a standalone bill, House File 3926, but it would be simpler just to include it in the department's policy bill today. The A2 simply restores the religious exemptions in the MHRA that protect religious organizations and faith-based schools against claims of gender identity discrimination when those claims would force that those religious organizations to violate their conscience, to violate their views, their religious views on those very sensitive and difficult questions. We have a number of testifiers signed up today that I think demonstrates that a large swath of the faith community supports this amendment. Catholics, Protestants of all backgrounds, Jews, and Muslims. Some of the groups that are seeking this exemption actually did oppose the inclusion in 1993 of sexual orientation and gender identity language in the MHRA because they thought all people should be protected from discrimination, but that concerns with religious freedom would be properly balanced in the MHRA.
And Representative Niska, I just want to make sure all those people have time to speak
Absolutely.
For themselves as well.
Absolutely.
You want to wrap up?
This exemption ensures that religious organizations and faith-based schools can, among other things, hire teachers and ministers consistent with their mission and values. And I would note that many of those groups did ask the commissioner to include this fix in her policy bill, and it's not there. If this was an oversight, I would invite the commissioner to explain the reason for that and whether what the department's position is on including this provision in their bill.
Okay, so just so I'm clear, are you wanting to get to testimony or do you want her to answer that question?
I would like her to answer that question at some point, but I don't really mind.
I can say,
we do that.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll just get to that right now. I mean, I can say as a legislator, it was not an oversight. I was aware that language was there. Commissioner Lucero.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Niska, the bill that's before us today is the bill from the Department of Human Rights, and I appreciate consideration of it. Thank you so much.
All right. We'll get to testimony. I've got first on the list, I've got President Baber. I'm sorry if I'm saying your name wrong. Yep. And then on deck, I have Dan Beckering. If when I tell you you're on deck, if you could also come up and come sit in one of the chairs here, I'll just keep things moving. Thank you. All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your
Thank
testimony.
You. Good morning, Madam Chair and member of the committees. My name is Zahir Babur, and I'm the president of the Islamic Center of Minnesota. Islamic Center of Minnesota was founded in mid-60s and is the first Islamic center in our state. Presently, we offer services to the Muslim community from two locations, one in Fridley and one in Columbia Heights. Under separate management at the Fridley building, we run a full-time Islamic school. Over 350 students attend that. The name of the school is Alamal School. Our prayers for the two Islamic Eids, Ramadan Eid and Eid al-Adha, is attended by over 10,000 people. We have over 200,000 Muslims in the state of Minnesota. Madam Chair and member of the committee, please consider adopting the A2 amendment, which would protect the religious organizations and schools by restoring the religious exemption in the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The removal last year of the religious exemption related to gender identity discrimination marginalizes people of faith by suggesting that what was held to be the common inheritance of all people regarding men, women, and the family is somehow discriminatory. We can respect all people while still allowing faith-based organizations to choose their leaders and teachers according to their missions and values. We want to believe the omission of the exemption was merely an oversight that can be fixed and that we can move forward together in a spirit of true pluralism, recognizing that different people have different values and that should be respected. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for keeping it to 2 minutes. Really appreciate that. Dan Beckering, and then I've got Reverend Hintz on deck. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. Dan Beckering, head of school at Southwest Christian High School in Chaska. We have 500 students in our high school. And then I'm also the Minnesota representative for the Association of Christian Schools International, and we have 33 ACSI schools in Minnesota serving 8,000 students and their families. Our state and education system are made stronger by the fact that Minnesota families can choose between a variety of public, private, and faith-based schools. Parents naturally desire to have their children taught in a school environment that is aligned with their values and convictions. When I meet prospective parents, the number one thing they want to hear from me is if I hire teachers to educate their children that will support and encourage their deeply held Christian beliefs. Faith-based institutions like my school cannot accomplish their mission if they do not have the autonomy to make governance and hiring decisions that are firmly aligned with their religious beliefs. These rights have always been protected by the U.S. and Minnesota constitutions and should be reflected in the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The omission of a religious exemption in the most recent version of MHRA is very concerning to the communities of Minnesota's 33 ACSI schools. Faith-based institutions following their religious beliefs should be protected from litigations related to matters of gender identity. Certainly questions of gender identity and expression are difficult and are generating much discussion in the culture at large. Prior to 2023, Minnesota had the statutory framework to protect the pluralism of values on this matter. This worked in the past, and I ask that the committee support the A2 amendment to restore the religious exemption related to gender identity. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Reverend Hintz, and then I have Mrs. Fasano on deck. Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
Chairman Becker Finn and members of the committee. My name is Reverend Frederick Hintz, and I speak as a representative of the roughly 500 congregations and schools of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod here in Minnesota. Our congregations and schools have long served the people of Minnesota, both by proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ and by helping to meet a wide variety of human needs. Indeed, we have been motivated to make these contributions to the common good because we adhere to the teachings of the Bible. In order to maintain the integrity and vitality of our ministry, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has always considered it crucial that our leaders be deeply and personally committed to the mission and values of our church, living them out in their personal lives, including matters related to sexual identity. Indeed, we have always regarded our ability to choose our leaders without government interference to be a core component of the religious liberty guaranteed to us in the Constitution. It is therefore disturbing to us when the state of Minnesota takes actions which place this fundamental right in jeopardy, as it has recently done. In fact, we regard the recent removal of the religious exemption from a portion of the Minnesota Human Rights Act to be a direct attack on the autonomy of the church and on the religious liberty rights of each of our members. Furthermore, in choosing to live our lives, acknowledging the reality of God-given biological sexual differences, we insist that far from being bigoted, we are in fact expressing a true love of neighbor. And so I urge you to respect the substantial and unique contributions of the church to our society by passing the A2 amendment, restoring once again the guarantee of religious liberty to our citizens, churches, and schools. I thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Mrs. Fasano? And please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Great. Good morning, everyone. I am Yen Fasano. I'm the Associate Director here for the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis with work directly dealing with the Drexel Mission Schools Initiative. This initiative was formed to support our urban schools who serve the highest concentration of disadvantaged students and families. We have shy of just 2,000 students, over 11 schools that are involved. In order for these schools to qualify to be an initiative that require a lot of resources and expenses, the schools must serve at minimum 50% students of color, 50% of families that are on free and reduced lunch, and a minimum of at least 100 students enrolled. And the majority of our schools serve well over 70% of those. That's really important because I'm asking you to support the A2 amendment to restore the religious exemption for the religious organizations and faith-based schools. We know the values of Catholic schools in these urban neighborhoods. It serves as an oasis, and it contributes widely to the greater community. And we serve these families and these students not because they are Catholic, but because we are Catholic, and we're rooted in the gospel teaching to have a preferential option for the poor and to teach them in virtue and formation of excellence. This issue matters to our Catholic schools in the Archdiocese because it is precisely our gospel value that motivates us to serve. We cannot compartmentalize our service to those with how we understand human sexuality. It is the same set of principles about the human dignity of each person that guides us both. Therefore, for us to continue serving the broader community, largely at our own expense, because these are not tuition-based model schools, it relies on the generosity and the resources of community partners and the services that we provide, we should be allowed to adopt policies, especially regarding who ministers, teaches, and form our students, consistent with our values and our mission. So I would deeply appreciate your support of the A2 amendment. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Moving on to member discussion. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know where to start. I heard a lot of key words in some of those testimonies. I heard the word respect. I heard about missions. And one that really stood out to me is disturbing. That's what this amendment is. This is very disturbing. I am appalled that we are having this discussion. I'll try to keep it as brief as I can, but this is infuriating. This is absolutely infuriating. Somebody had mentioned that this is a direct attack, and you're absolutely right. This is a direct attack against the trans and non-binary communities, not just here in Minnesota, but across the country, where we are seeing people flee their states because of things like this. Last session, Minnesota said, you are welcome here, and we're not going to dial that back. We stand firm that all are welcome here in Minnesota. So no, you cannot respect all people when you don't believe certain people exist. And I'm here to say that we do exist, and we're sitting in this room right in front of you. So if you can't understand identity, whether it's sexual identity or gender identity, perhaps, just perhaps, you might want to look people in the eye who do exist and are telling you that we are here as non-binary or trans. You can no longer claim that we don't exist or that you don't believe we are here. If you don't believe I am here, who is speaking to you right now? You need to hear this. If we are talking about dignity, where is the dignity in not recognizing our fellow neighbors? Where is the dignity in saying you are not accepted here? In accomplishing what mission exactly? Is that to erase thousands of people who are already here, people who have existed since the beginning of time? People are finally having the voice and finding the space and feeling safe enough to say who they are after, since the beginning of time, when folks like testifiers here told people, no, you can't be yourself. No, we don't accept you. We don't believe you exist. We think you are other. We think you're just confused. Where is this amendment and legislation coming from? Like, literally, what year is this coming from? We are in 2024. This is absolutely, absolutely ridiculous. And I cannot believe that we continue to have this discussion when people are sitting right in front of you. We have people fleeing to Minnesota, hundreds of families, trans families, families of trans children. And you're saying, nope, you don't exist. You're just not here. Well, the joke's on you, because who are you looking at? Who are you talking to? We do exist. We are here. This amendment is disgusting. This is totally disrespectful. And when you, when folks have arguments that put discrimination in one hand and anything else in the other, as if there's some sort of balance, are you kidding me? Take the one hand with discrimination, turn it over and throw it on the floor. And that's what we should do with this amendment. Thank you.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Curran, for your comments. I just want to say that, you know, I carried a Minnesota Department of Human Rights bill last year. It was very difficult. We moved something that was very important to our community, and we, you know, we didn't do it because we were trying to say to the religious community of Minnesota that we don't respect you. We said, we've been here now for, at that point, we'd had representation for the first time for a couple months. We had trans people in office for a few months, and we took a large step towards protecting our rights and representing ourselves. And when you do that, when you are a part of a marginalized community, this is so not unique to the trans community, you take a step forward, and then you spend a few years defending that, maybe moving backwards. This is what happens. This is what's happening here. I think that what we won last year was extremely important, and you just heard about the importance of that. And the right to discriminate against my community, we're not going to just say yes. We're not just going to say sure. We don't want you to discriminate against us. That's what we're trying to do. And I know that we don't agree. I also believe in pluralism. I ran on pluralism. Pluralism is having the opportunity to come to your government and quote the Bible to your elected officials in an effort to make your case. We are hearing that. We heard that right now. That is a pluralistic society in which we make choices, and those choices affect the lives of the people who live here. We are not attacking pluralism. We are making steps towards equality and equity and dignity for communities that are extremely at risk, extremely at risk. If they were not at risk, they wouldn't be fleeing states. We have refugees moving to Minnesota. You heard this, and it's not a joke. States are doing everything they can to literally, actually erase and eradicate trans people and encourage them to leave where they live because they are not safe. Now, I understand that these schools want to hire teachers that they will continue to hire. They just will. We know how private institutions work. I went to many private institutions. We get it. This isn't doing anything other than saying to us, we want to continue to ensure that our children feel scared to be where they are. They are in your schools. Trans kids are in your schools, 100%, every single one of your schools. And I want you to know that they can hear you. They heard you say that they should not, that you should be legally allowed to discriminate against them. And I'm really sorry to those kids. And Madam Chair, I would like to request a roll call vote.
All right. Roll call having been requested. Further discussion to the A2 amendment. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the discussion today. I just want to say that we are not here trying to erase anyone. We are here trying to uphold a constitutional right that was foundational to our state and our country. And what's being erased here is the ability for folks with deeply held beliefs to keep and stay in line with those deeply held beliefs. And so when we talk about marginalized communities, what's happening is the faith community is being marginalized right now. That's what's happening here. This is a building block of our country, and I know many of you have problems with that. But it's a building block of our country. It's been upheld. Religious liberties have been upheld by the Supreme Court of the United States and of this country over the course of the history of our country. And what's happening right now is you're trying to erase that. and that's not okay. I hope people in the public are listening to this conversation. They're trying to erase religious freedom in the United States of America, in the state of Minnesota. This is a pivotal point, folks. Please support the A2 amendment.
And I do want to clarify, too, that this is basically, this discussion is a relitigation of the bill that we passed last year, because there's nothing in the underlying bill that addresses this topic specifically. And I just wanted to clarify with research, it's my understanding, under current law, they can still discriminate based on sexual orientation, correct?
Chair and members, the existing law, which you can see here for religious and fraternal organizations, includes an exemption for sexual orientation for these religious organizations.
Thank you. Representative Frederick?
I just want to say that it is hard to sit here and listen to some of the testifiers that have come up to share. I was raised Catholic. I went to Catholic school. I was one of those kids that you're describing, going to a K-12 education in a Catholic school, going to church every week at school, going to church every weekend with my parents. The core takeaway of that education for me and my religious background was to love thy neighbor, was to accept thy neighbor. You want to come up and preach? I want to think of a Bible quote that says, those without sin cast the first stone. Everyone that came up to testify today was casting stones. Hatred throughout our history has shown up in different ways. Judgment in our history has shown up in different ways. Go back far enough, that deeply held belief was that someone of a different skin color is a substandard human being, and we should be able to treat them however we want. That was the, quote, status quo of the time. The status quo sometimes needs to be broken. Hatred today shows up as an amendment of adding the words gender identity to a bill, which is antithetical to my upbringing and is a hatred that I will not be part of. So I ask the committee to vote no.
Thank you. And I'll just say, because I do think it's important for the legislative record, we didn't actually have this discussion when the bill language was in front of us. I think there were some other provisions in that bill that folks were maybe more focused on, but there was a full committee process and open legislative process with chances along the way in this committee, in Ways and Means, on the House floor, to fully have this conversation at the time when the language is actually in front of us when we voted on it. Representative Niska, closing comments on the 8-2 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. Thank you for requesting the roll call, Representative Finke. I was going to request a roll call. Well, folks, the mask is off. This is a very simple question about religious freedom, religious pluralism, or government control. Are the religious views of religious associations, religious corporations, religious societies, or any institution organized for educational purposes that is operated, supervised, and controlled by a religious association, religious corporation, or religious society, that's the language from the bill, that's all we're talking about, are the views of those organizations controlled by the individual freedom of the religious people who form those associations, or are they controlled by the governor and the legislature of the state of Minnesota? That's the question we're voting on here today. If you think that those religious views should be controlled by the legislators here who told the testifiers that their religious views are wrong, then vote no. If you think that we should have pluralism in Minnesota so that the DFL legislators who express their religious views should be allowed to hold them, and religious organizations that hold different views should also be allowed to hold them and live out those views, then you need to vote yes if you support the First Amendment protecting freedom of speech that protects ministerial protections for religious organizations to choose who is part of their religious organization, how they organize themselves to be consistent with their religious faith, then you need to vote yes. And I hope that the people of Minnesota are watching, because I think that people of faith are the people that are being marginalized here. The administration and the majority has declared open season on traditional faith, saying you are welcome here, as I heard across the other side of the aisle. That's only true for some Minnesotans. Everyone on the other side, yes, you exist, but your existence does not give you the right to tell other people how they can believe and how they can practice their faith. Religious testifiers here were told that they're not welcome, that they're casting stones, that their religious views are wrong. That's not one Minnesota. That's one way. That's one view. That's government control. That is totalitarianism. It's wrong. Vote yes.
All right. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier.
No.
Lead Scott.
Aye.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Feist.
No.
Representative Finke.
No.
Representative Frederick.
No.
Representative Grossel.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Mueller.
No.
Representative Niska.
Yes.
Representative Weens.
Aye.
Five ayes, eight nays.
All right. With five ayes and eight nays, the amendment is not adopted. Representative Grossel, if you would like to speak, you could have gotten on the list to speak, but we're not going to have you muttering over there.
I said it nice and clear.
Right, but you don't get to speak unless you're asked, when given permission to speak in the committee. We can't just have people randomly muttering things into microphones during my committee. And if you cannot control yourself, then you can step out of the committee, but you're not going to do that in my committee. You can stare at me the whole committee, and it's not going to change the rules of the rules, and they're the same for everybody. All right, the underlying bill as amended. Closing comments, Representative Frederick. I guess there were folks who wanted to be on the list, but they hadn't gotten on the list. Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, I thought we were taking up the amendment, then we would get on the list to take up the entire bill. So sure. I have several questions on the bill.
Great. Sure. Great. You don't need to be mad about it. I didn't realize.
Boom, you just went so fast.
Yeah, well, we've got a long agenda, and we did not have that much time set aside. So we will come back at 12:15 today to finish the agenda.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. And I had several questions on just the bill, Representative Frederick. In Section 7, why are we removing those starts on line 3.18 to 3.21? I'm just trying to understand why those why that language is being stricken.
I think Commissioner Lucero, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair. That's a great question. So the purpose of this proposed amendment here is to eliminate any conflicting language that currently exists. So if you see the title of it, it says publication of case account, and it very clearly says that the commissioner may publish an account of a case in which the complaint has been dismissed or where we have, you know, settled the case. And then the second sentence there can sometimes result in some confusion, because it says the commissioner shall not disclose any information concerning efforts in a particular case to eliminate an unfair discriminatory practice through education, conference, conciliation, and persuasion. That conflicts, or at least it creates some confusion with the entire powers and duties of the commissioner under 363A.06 subdivision 1, where it's the responsibility of the commissioner to attempt by means of education, conference, conciliation, and persuasion to eliminate unfair discriminatory practices. That is the work of the agency to make sure we're sharing information about discrimination and making sure that we're putting a stop to it before it even arises. We want to be transparent with folks about what's going on to prevent it from happening in the first place. And so where there is confusion there, we want to make sure we're eliminating that confusion by saying, hey, we can publish this where it is resolved. Where we get questions around this is around, hey, are you going to disclose personal information about what was discussed in the settlement or in negotiations? And no, everything has to remain confidential. So what we don't want to see, and these are well-established rules, are where somebody says, I came to the table originally with a low offer and then I raised it, or I wasn't really willing to make changes to the policy and then I changed them and now I am. Once a case is settled, we are talking about the publishing the account of that, and that's what this is eliminating here.
Representative Scott.
All right. Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm not sure I followed all of that, Commissioner Lucero. I'm just wanting to make sure that I'm not asking for, you know, that the any form of government put out the, you know, in a case like this, the personally identifiable information, but you'll still have the ability to share, like, the, for all intents and purposes, you could redact a case, you could redact the names and so forth and still present the work that you've been doing.
Commissioner Lucero.
Yeah. Committee. Chair Beckerfin, Representative Scott. Yes, great question. We have very strict data practices rules that we have to abide by, and there's different confidentiality rules around that. And so we do have different redaction requirements under data practices.
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then Representative Frederick, I'm just wondering on line 4.21, where it references service animal, is that the statutory definition of a service animal that's a certified service animal, or is that just like a therapy animal could be scooped into that? Just kind of wondering if we're broadening something there or what.
I'm assuming Representative Frederick doesn't have that definition immediately in front of him, but Representative Frederick.
Thank you. We're not defining in that very specific line what a service animal is. I think a service animal defined by statute is a dog or, in rare cases, a miniature horse. But it's not. That's not here. I mean, that section of the entire statute is that we're saying that we're taking out the language that talks about blind, deaf, or other. We're just not putting those categories, and we're saying people who are disabled may have a service animal, and that disability can look differently in different places. Is all we're trying to acknowledge in that section.
As far as I know, dogs are the best at it. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The dogs are the best at anything when it comes to that. I just don't see these people that have therapy peacocks as being particularly, you know, comforted by them. But anyway, another question on the section on tolling. And did the OLA, you mentioned the OLA, Commissioner Lucero, the OLA's recommendations, did they also recommend that you broaden and lengthen by 6 months the time allowed in this section?
Commissioner.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Scott, we did not broaden the time allowed. If you look at, hold on, let me find the, this isn't the right, 5.24. If you look at what is crossed out in, give me 1 second here, 6.8, 6.7, 6.8, 6.9. The commissioner shall make a determination of probable cause or no probable cause within 1 year of the filing of the case. So we have maintained the 1 year statute of limitations. We just moved it up from where it is here in this mess and moved it up. But the statute of limitations stays the same.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for that clarification. My final question has to do with the civil penalty punitive damages. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious behind the thinking of no cap at all on small businesses or businesses that are found to be in violation of this area of law compared to political subdivisions having a cap of only $25,000. Why the difference? I mean, if somebody's violating a section of statute, shouldn't they be held at the same level of accountability in a consistent manner?
Commissioner?
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Scott, are you proposing that we eliminate the cap in paragraph B here?
Representative Scott.
Well, it seems like you're treating two entities very differently, so I'm trying to understand why you put a cap on one and not the other.
Commissioner.
Thank you. Chair Beckerfin, Representative Scott, that is just language that's moved over directly from point 29. That's not anything that I did. It is verbatim in point 29, so 363.29, it's there right now. So again, if you look at point 29, you'll see a whole remedy section there under administrative law judges. And it's not there for district courts. And so we need to move the whole remedy section over, and that is in section 29 right now. I didn't write this section. It's just moved over. I know it looks like it did because it's underlined, but that's over there in point 29.
Representative Scott. Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll look into that. I find it a very glaring discrepancy in the way different entities are treated for the same violations under law, and it just seems, you know, like it's unfair. So thanks, Madam Chair.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. My question is, I think, a fairly straightforward one. It's about the definition of disability in Section 2. The federal ADA uses the word substantial, where we're using the word materially, and I just was hoping the commissioner would explain the reason for that language choice and what effect you think that has on this definition compared to the federal definition.
Commissioner.
Chair, man, I need water. Chair Beckerfin. Representative Niska, that's a great question. So this language, when it comes to materially, has been the law in Minnesota for, oh man, quite some time, and it's well-established case law. I would have to go back and do some research for when that came about. We are not making any distinction on that word, so I'm not prepared to talk about the distinction around that word today. I'd be happy to talk with you offline about that.
Anything else, Representative Niska?
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin and Commissioner Lucero. I was hoping you could just speak a little bit to the changing in the timelines, lengthening some of the timelines. I have some concerns that lessens the certainty that respondents are going to have. It extends out their time of uncertainty, and was hoping for an explanation for the policy behind those changes.
Commissioner.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Niska, thank you for that question. So I think first and foremost, they respondents certainly have certainty. It's a 90-day certainty. And I think also you'll see that the right to sue letters that are issued by the EEOC are 90 days. And so actually having a 90-day and a 45-day at the state level was actually creating confusion and discrepancy both by respondents and by charging parties. And so this actually provides that consistency and clarity and it just ends it right there at that 90 days for everybody.
Representative Niska.
That's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Frederick. I don't know what to say on this bill. Any type of discrimination is bad. I was taught that we are all the same. Didn't matter what race, creed, color, anything.
And Representative Johns, I just want to remind you that we're past the point of talking about the amendments. We're just going to talk about
the amendment. This is this.
Let me finish talking. I just was going to remind you, if you just keep your comments to the underlying bill, that would be great. Thank you. Representative Grossel. You do not get to make snide comments off to the side while we are having committee. It is in the rules.
Madam Chair, you're making snide comments to our members all the time. Let them speak.
Representative Grassley, you do not get to decide when you get to speak into the microphones. You are not the chair of this committee. If you cannot control yourself, then you can leave. But everybody follows the same rules. If Representative Carroll was making comments that we could pick up on the mics, I would call him out on it. You don't get to do this. You are not the chair of the committee. Representative Johnson has the floor. And this is your last warning. I will go to the Ethics Committee if I need to, but it's ridiculous. We can't get our work done if we have people not following the rules. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, members, as I was saying, I was taught that discrimination is bad. We're all the same. In fact, our DNA is almost identical from person to person, if you go back, except for a few things, less than 1% different. Our Constitution of the United States grants us rights. This bill is discriminatory. We had an opportunity to fix it. We didn't. It's disappointing. In 1771, our Bill of Rights was written, giving us the first 10 rights that we have in the Bill of Rights, constitutional rights. And the very first one we discussed earlier, including freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and a few other freedoms. Unfortunately, this bill takes some of that away, forcing individuals to do things against their religious beliefs, while others can have their religious, different type of religious beliefs.
Representative Johnson, there's nothing to religious beliefs in the underlying bill.
So, with what this bill is missing, I'm going to be requesting a roll call.
All right. Any further committee discussion? All right. Not seeing any. Representative Frederick, closing comments.
It's a good bill. Please vote yes.
All right. A roll call having been requested, Representative Frederick renews his motion that House File 4021 as amended be placed on the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Lead Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Weist.
Aye.
Representative Finger.
Yes.
Representative Frederick.
Yes.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weens.
No.
8 ayes, 5 nays.
All right, with 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Frederick. Next up on the agenda, we've got House File 3640. I thought I saw Chair Hurt. Yep. Commissioner Villablette, you're still up here, I guess. You don't get to go anywhere, sorry. Representative Hurt, I will move to recommend that House File 3640 be placed on the General Register. There is a copy of the fiscal note in members' packets if they do have questions about that. Representative Hurt, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, and thank you, Committee, for hearing House File 3640. I had a lot of remarks prepared, but I see that there's been a lot of discussion, and I'll make this short for all of you. I know you have a lot of bills on your plate here. And really, this bill is just an act to prohibit discrimination based on the source of income. As you all know, there are different ways in which we supplement individuals who meet a certain threshold in order for them to be able to afford their rents. And really, I think what's important for us to remember is that for 50 years, Minnesota Human Rights Act has prohibited housing discrimination based on renters' status with regard to public assistance. This bill simply clarifies that the existing protection from discrimination as it relates to status with regards to public assistance does, in fact, cover renters using housing vouchers. So it just honors the original intent of the language. We're not changing anything. We're just, you know, really trying to align these two items together. This clarifying bill is key to ensuring Minnesota's families and not discriminated against because of the way they pay their rent, and the historic investments we made last year requires that we actually sort of fix this piece of it so that we can, the individuals who have these vouchers can do so. And so with that, I'm just going to turn it over to Representative Lucero to give a little bit of Commissioner Lucero to give a little bit of background and share some information regarding this bill. And I just want to remind this committee that the reason why I'm sort of blowing through some of these details is because this bill was in front of the committee last year already, and we had a very full discussion at that time as well. And so with that, I will turn it over to Commissioner Lucero.
Thank you. Commissioner.
Hi. Commissioner Rebecca Lucero, Department of Human Rights. Good to see you all again. So I will also be really brief. There's a lot of folks here to speak on this. So I will just provide a couple pieces of context. It might be helpful to note that under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, it is a violation of the law to discriminate based on public assistance in several areas. So you cannot discriminate against somebody on public assistance in employment. So I cannot, for instance, say, I don't want somebody who lives in Section 8 housing to work for me. That would be a violation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. I cannot say, I don't want a kid who's on free or reduced lunch in my AP class. They're not the right kind of kids for me. That would be a violation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And in housing, in 1973, similarly, the legislators said that it would be a violation for a landlord to discriminate against someone because they pay their rent with rental assistance. So legislators have been very intentional about this for a long time, that when it comes to education, employment, and housing, you can't discriminate against somebody for a variety of reasons: race, age, disability, where they have their source of income from. In this situation here, the reason we're talking about this is because there was a 2010 Court of Appeals case that wrongly applied the Minnesota Human Rights Act when it said that, hey, when it comes to programs like Section 8, that's not what we mean when we say public assistance. That was misapplied, and that's why legislators have an obligation to clarify what has been the law for 50 years since 1973 and say when it comes to employment, education, housing, public assistance discrimination is not allowed. And so I'm going to I'll just stop there and be available for any questions if you have. Thank okay. you.
And I do have a couple testifiers. First up, I have Ivory Taylor. And then I have Heidi Storm on deck. Thank you to our amazing pages for finding water for our commissioner. back in my day, we had coffee in these rooms in the morning, but post-COVID, that hasn't been the deal. So I know. It would have to come out of my campaign committee. Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Becker Finn and honorable members of the committee. My name is Ivory Taylor, and I'm the Associate Director of Housing Justice Center. I'm here to testify in support of House File 3640. For the past 6.5 years that I've been employed in the housing justice field, I've had the honor to work with and on behalf of Minnesotans statewide. Many of the folks I've connected with have experienced housing instability, homelessness, and our lack of access to appropriate housing types. These issues are caused by an inability to afford ever-increasing rents, discriminatory barriers, and a historical lack of tenant protections which ensure the property rights of both landlords and renters. Adults, children, individuals, and families, disabled folks, seniors, immigrants, students, employed, underemployed, and unemployed folks, mm-hmm. small business owners, people from every walk of life in Minnesota are negatively impacted by a housing system that does not work for everyone. This is a struggle that I know personally. Growing up in poverty in Minnesota, my family and I relied on housing choice vouchers and the shelter systems to keep a roof over our heads. Living in a home where there was domestic violence, without a prohibition on source of income discrimination in place, we lived through a revolving door of housing instability. We were unable to easily find safety in another place because there was nowhere to go that would take our voucher. Going back and forth from home to shelter to search of safety involved constantly changing schools, losing privacy, facing ongoing physical violence, and further deteriorating the mental and physical health of my caregiver until they were no longer able to work. Every day we ask our communities to make the impossible happen, raise families in safe and healthy environments, achieve high educational outcomes, maintain optimum health, work and excel at jobs, be civic-minded and rooted in our communities, participate in faith or community organizations, and give back to others. I ask myself often how this is possible for anyone, but especially for the unhoused mother who may lose her kids to out-of-home placement because she can't find a stable home that will accept her family unification voucher, or the Minnesotan living with mental illness who loses their home when a new owner won't accept bridges payments, or the veteran whose health deteriorates when their VASH voucher won't be accepted by landlords in a location close to where the VA is, or the newly resettled Afghan family who cannot use their refugee rental assistance to live close to other resettled families where there's cultural connection and supportive housing. It's not a choice to seek and obtain housing, especially when being unhoused is met with policing and criminalization, a lack of deeply affordable long-term and stable housing options, and support systems that don't fully work. As Minnesotans, we promise people during some of the hardest times of their lives that we will show up for them, help them, and give them access to what they need. We cannot let this promise be unfulfilled because of discrimination. That's why it's imperative that we pass House File 3640 this legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up, I have Heidi Storm, and then I have Holly Brannick on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Heidi Storm. Dear Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee, my name is Heidi Storm, and I'm a resident of Maplewood, Minnesota. I'm here to testify in support of House File 3640 on preventing rental discrimination based on someone's use of public assistance. I grew up in Sibley County, Minnesota, and I am a low-income autistic adult with other disabilities living on SSDI. I have experienced ongoing housing instability due to difficulty maintaining employment and meeting my basic needs before receiving diagnosis and support for my disabilities, made only worse by the challenges I have faced in acquiring stable and accessible housing in a location of my choice with a Section 8 voucher. After moving to St. Peter in Nicollet County as an adult, I experienced ongoing housing instability moving from place to place until I finally found some stability in a home rented to me by a local couple who were regular customers at the coffee shop where I worked at the time. This was my first apartment without roommates in my life. This home was central to the community, had a porch I could sit on, was in walking distance to my job in good weather, and felt like home to me. While living there, I was working toward acquiring services to meet my disability needs and was finally able to secure a Section 8 voucher. Once I received my voucher, however, I was displaced from this home that I loved because my landlords would not accept the voucher, even though we had a great relationship as renter and landlord. I ended up having to move to a new property that was on the north end of town that was owned by a larger corporation that was harder to engage with and did not meet my sensory needs for sound sensitivity. After living in that location for 4 years, I was able to get all of my disability needs met in St. Peter, so I decided to move to the Twin Cities metro area. My goal was to move to Dakota County, where peers involved in disability advocacy indicated that support services were easier to access. I enlisted the help of the ARCS Housing Access Services, and even with their support, was only able to tour two apartments which would accept vouchers and had vacancies. My housing access worker had no awareness of sensory-friendly accessible housing. Advocating for my sensory-related disability needs did not result in better access to appropriate housing. So in the rare case that I could find sensory-friendly housing, the risk of a landlord choosing not to accept my voucher would make it even harder to get my needs met.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Holly Brannick. And then I've got, Cecil Smith on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you for having me today, Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee. My name is Holly Brannick, and I am a Youth Services Program Manager for Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota in Rochester. I oversee some of our housing programs, including our Safe Harbor Housing for youth who have experienced sexual exploitation or sex trafficking. Thank you for the opportunity to share Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota's support of House File 3640. LSS provides a seamless continuum of supports to youth experiencing homelessness. This includes street outreach, youth resource centers, emergency shelter, transitional housing, independent living skills, and one-on-one assistance to help youth find and maintain stable housing and achieve life goals. We serve youth in more than 40 Minnesota counties from locations in Duluth, Virginia, Brainerd, St. Cloud, Wilmer, Mankato, Rochester, and St. Paul. Our organization assists youth obtaining and maintaining housing choice vouchers specifically identified for youth who were in foster care. This is known as FYI voucher or foster youth to independence, which is a HUD voucher administered by public housing agencies. The number one barrier we face in placing youth in stable housing is with property owners and property management companies refusing to work with housing subsidies. Modifying the Human Rights Act to clarify housing discrimination based on a person's source of income as illegal is needed to ensure youth that we serve are not prevented from utilizing their housing assistance to secure stable housing. I'd like to share a story of one of our youth who faced barriers in gaining housing because of source of income discrimination. I've worked with her for 4 years in our Safe Harbor housing program. I was able to find her housing during the pandemic, and this youth was able to find a job, get her high school diploma, and started to build a community within a local church. After being in an apartment for over a year, the property owner opted not to renew her lease and was only given 2 months' notice. Together, we tried to find her new housing. It took us 5 months to find a property owner willing to work with housing subsidies. As a result, during this five-month search, we had to place her in a hotel for 3 months. Imagine living in a hotel for 3 months not knowing where you're going to end up. Today, this youth is doing amazing things. She just passed her nursing assistant skills test and is attending college with dreams of becoming an oncology nurse.
And Ms. Brannick, I'll have to ask you to wrap up.
Yes. This youth is set to graduate from our program at the end of the year and has grown to be a remarkable strong woman. Supporting House File 3640 would help youth who have endured so much to more quickly find stable housing so they can move to live full, abundant lives. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for your testimony. Last, I have Mr. Smith. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cecil Smith. I'm President and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, representing 2,200 members who own 300,000 units of rental housing in the state of Minnesota, serving 600,000 residents. I'm here today to respectfully raise our opposition to House File 3640. This proposal would require participation in the federal government's Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program. Section 8 is a voluntary federal program that allows housing providers to elect to participate in the program. MHA believes that this program works best as designed, as an optional program. Local public housing authorities administer the program and work to recruit and retain housing providers to the Section 8 program. Several years ago, concerns were raised with the approach of the Minneapolis voucher program. In response, the local public housing authority reformed the program through incentives and improved communication. These reforms led to the private housing market increasing their participation. State and local government regularly enter agreements with housing developers, which include provisions requiring acceptance of Section 8 vouchers. As the state of Minnesota continues to invest in housing, more rental housing opportunities become available to voucher holders. Since 2019, Minnesota Housing has invested in over 7,000 new multifamily rental units that have agreed to accept Section 8 vouchers in their development agreement. Participation in the Section 8 program is more than just receiving a rent subsidy for a resident provided by the government. It requires the acceptance of the HAP contract, complying with the contract's requirements, and having the contract supersede your lease terms, including the inability to end the lease when the housing authority does not pay. We remain opposed to compelling a housing provider to sign a contract with the federal government. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Carroll.
I just wanted to ask the...
Representative Carroll, if you want to make sure you speak in the mic.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and to the author. Just wanted to clarify that in... Line 1.8 through 110, the definition of public assistance program includes those on health programs, for example, from DHS, MA, et cetera. But it's not limited to housing.
Representative Herr.
Chair Beckerfin, and Representative Carroll, can you just repeat that line number because I don't see
them
in your
reference.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. 1.8 through 110, the definition of public assistance program.
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Lucero will answer the question for Representative Carroll.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Carroll. So this is actually specifically related to housing. It's in the housing section of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. There are other sections with regards to public assistance in the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and that those areas around employment, public service, education, and credit. And those are some of the specific areas I can, that's where, but this is about housing specifically.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you. So I'm still confused. I'm just wanting to make sure that those who are on public health assistance programs won't be discriminated against because they receive, for example, MA.
I'm actually going to go to House Research, Ms. Davis.
Chair and members, if you look at Section 2 and again in Section 3, you can see that there's a list of all of the various protected classes, and one of them is status with regards to public assistance. And that's right before this new language. So that is part of the already existing statute.
Great, thank you.
Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Herr, my understanding is that there's, that this issue is in litigation right now. There's a case called Fletcher versus Minneapolis. And I'm wondering, as a legislature, in the past, kind of our precedent has been, if there's something other under litigation, we kind of stay out of the matter until that is resolved. And so I'm wondering what might make this different, this issue.
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, I haven't been here as long as you have, so I can't really answer to the precedent of what the body does, but I will defer to Commissioner Lucero for so that she can touch on this topic for you.
Commissioner.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Scott, the case you're probably referring to is Fletcher. The Court of Appeals just ruled on that a couple weeks ago and found that it's the issue before that is constitutional, which was the question that they were looking at. So it keeps getting upheld successfully, and so that is now resolved, and we're looking to fix the issue that was created in 2010 by the Court of Appeals, and that's what this is moving forward on at this time.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Herr, what about this ability for a housing provider to voluntarily enter in? Don't you always have an option whether to enter into a contract or not? And this is taking away the right to make a decision based on the facts and what works best for your, I mean, some of these housing providers that they live on one side of the duplex and they rent out the other side. So there's a lot at stake for these folks. They want to make sure that they're renting to the right people that are going to take care of the property and abide by the all the things. And they want the best opportunity to be assured that they're going to be paid. So with what was testified to about the Section 8 program and it being voluntary, why should we compel a housing provider to basically take away any option they have to enter into a contract freely?
Representative Herr.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Scott, thank you for that question. And I think that this goes back to, I think we had this discussion last year, is that someone who is renting a unit can actually still look at all of the requirements and criteria in order to rent that unit. So if somebody has a, you know, reasons on their record as to why you wouldn't rent to them, you can still make those decisions. It's just a saying that you can't make the sole decision on somebody's how they're choosing to pay for that unit. And I also want to just remind the body that, you know, I know that this is a voluntary program, but actually to be a part of the program, there's only two steps that a landlord has to take in order to be a part of it. And I think that, you know, again, all they're saying is that they're going to look at all the other criteria to determine if somebody should be a renter for them and not to just discriminate based on one criteria and that their source of income and how they're paying.
Representative Scott. Thank you, Madam Chair. So isn't there current language in law that says you can't discriminate based on credit? Representative Herr?
Commissioner, Representative Herr, whoever wants to take it.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Scott, I am not aware of that, but I'm going to defer to Commissioner Lucero.
Commissioner.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Scott, there are different protected class statuses where you're prohibited from discriminating against regarding credit. So, for instance, if you you can't discriminate against somebody because of their race when it comes to whether or not you're getting good credit.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, Representative Scott.
No, thank you for that clarification. I just don't think it's wise to set a precedent that requires a private business to enter into a contract that requires them. That isn't, I guess that isn't really a contract then. It's a mandate. The government's telling them how to run their business. So it's really, it's regulatory in nature in my mind. I think this is not a good precedent to start, and so I'll be voting no. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, and I do have Representative Johnson. I'm sorry I didn't have you go last. He raised his hand after you started talking. So, Representative Johnson, and we have a testifier that has to catch a flight, and we do need to end on time. So, if everyone can try to keep their answers succinct, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative, I understand what you're doing here. I don't know if you're aware, we're about 100 to 110 units short for housing in the state of Minnesota. Well, we just got done with Biden inflation, hyperinflation, and rent goes up dramatically under inflation, much more than anything else. Now, putting another burden on our housing providers is not going to help. What's going to happen when they're mandated to take these vouchers, what's going to happen is they're going to raise their rent to the point where the vouchers aren't going to cover, they won't be able to cover the cost. They'll find a way around it. Plus the fact that it requires a contract under duress to be signed with the federal government in order to have a rental unit. A contract signed under duress is not valid. This is a bad idea. I think giving incentives for these housing providers to take the vouchers is a better way. You attract them more. But it should be a option for the housing providers. Currently in Greater Minnesota, we're short rental units. We're even short more starter homes. And those starter homes are also the finishing home. They're the bookends of life and bookends of the family. Something like this requiring these things is going to make rental units even less available, especially in Greater Minnesota. This summer I toured a facility in St. Paul, public housing through the Public Housing Authority. Down here, they only have 70% occupancy. And they take the vouchers. But forcing them to do that, you're going to have less people willing to put up these homes, build the apartment buildings. You're going to have less people building duplexes and renting part of it out so they can have a payment, so they can have their first home. This is the exact opposite of what we need to do. Members vote no.
Closing comments, Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Breckerfin, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for that question. And I just want to say that if incentive is what we are looking for, then this is the greatest incentive you can have, that no matter how great inflation is, that you are always going to have your rent paid by an assured source of income. And even if somebody can't make that full payment, the government gets to step in and tell you you will get paid. I don't know what greater incentive there is to that. So thank you so much, committee, for hearing. I just want to just remind this body that banning source of income discrimination is already law in 17 states. We are not doing anything new here, and over 90 localities nationwide. And so it's time for Minnesota to follow suit and to ensure that all of our landlords get their payments and have secured income source coming in for the properties that they own. And so I ask this body to vote yes.
All right. Thank you, Representative Herr. I will renew my motion that House File 3640 be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is on its way to the general register. We're going to get one more bill done before we go into recess. Representative Curran, would you like to move to recommend that House File 3868 be placed on the general register? We
yes,
learned
sir.
All about the UCC the other day, so we won't go into that. But Representative Curran, please tell us about your bill.
Yes, thank you. I will be brief. Bill number 3868
is amendments to our Uniform Commercial Code regarding emerging technologies. Quite riveting. There's a lot of information in front of you, and I will turn it over to a testifier for further details.
Yeah, thank you. Please introduce yourself and proceed. And I should clarify, the UCC and the ULC are different. The UCC is what I put my laptop on when I have Zoom meetings, and the ULC is a commission of people who meet. Please go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, I'm Michelle Timmons, Uniform Law Commissioner and former reviser of statutes. Last Thursday, I talked at some length about the Uniform Law Commission process, and I want to assure you that the Uniform Commercial Code amendments that are before you today have gone through that same vetting and stakeholder process that I described last week. Secondly, the Uniform Commercial Code is the example I give when people ask me, well, can you give me an example of the Uniform Law Commission's work? I say, well, have you ever heard of the Uniform Commercial Code? It's really been the crown jewel of the Uniform Law Commission's work and facilitated business across the states. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Commissioner Lowe to go into more detail about the bill.
All right. Commissioner Lowe, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. My name is Kim Lowe. I'm an attorney here in the state of Minnesota. I have the pleasure of being one of your Minnesota Uniform Law Commissioners, and I'm also a member of the Minnesota State Bar Association, where I've chaired the business law section. So I'm here wearing two hats, one as a commissioner and one also as a representative of the business bar here in the state of Minnesota. The uniform law, anyone who's a lawyer knows what the UCC is. We don't have to get too deep into it. It's scintillating. The bill in front of you is 132 pages. As Representative Curran introduced it, it is being updated. The UCC is being updated to take into account new technologies that have happened. The UCC was first adopted in Minnesota in the 1960s. It is not amended regularly, but the hope is to bring it current when new technologies arise. There is a new article that's being added to the Uniform Commercial Code, Article 12, and that takes into account what are called digital assets. And digital assets are certain things that are now promulgated running around in our economy that have been created, and we need to update the UCC to make sure that when people have those assets, that they are part of commerce and being used in commerce. A perfect example is if someone has an NFT or one of these other digital assets, and they want to pledge it as security for a loan. Right now, we don't have a mechanism that allows that to happen. What the amendments to the UCC are allowing to happen is if that person who has that digital asset does want to use that, say, as a personal loan or security for a personal loan, they can do that. Without these, we have to sort of run through a bunch of hoops to try to figure out how to bring that person's asset into our banking system, into our system in general. Another one of these changes that's happening in the Uniform Commercial Code is bringing current our what are called negotiable instruments, also another very dry, boring law school class. Negotiable instruments are checks. You remember we all used to write checks. Well, now we don't write checks, right? We pay for things in very different ways, and we also deposit checks in very different ways. I don't know about you, but I don't know how many of you have stood there with your iPhone and deposited your check that way. The UCC right now has been working without a pure mechanism to make that happen. So these amendments are really just trying to bring forward what people are doing so that the law sort of accords itself with what's out there. It doesn't create new things. It doesn't create currency. It doesn't do anything like that. What it does is bring current the law to deal with the assets and the things that people are doing due to technology. That's what it does. It's pretty simple. It's very long. I'll take questions from any lawyer or anyone else who wants to ask me. Go for it. Thank you for putting me in. I'm the one who has to get on a plane, but I appreciate any questions anyone might have.
Don't go for it. We don't need to describe blockchain technology. Luckily, there's only one attorney over here, so Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, and thank you, Representative Curran, for taking on this issue. I know it's super exciting, and thank you to both of the law commissioners for coming today and for the conversations we have had around this and other ULC issues. I really appreciate it. The one question I wanted to talk about was just the change, the one change that's different from the ULC version of these, which is the addition of some language about a national digital currency. So I was wondering if you, if either of you wanted to address that.
Sure. Go ahead.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Niska. There has been some concern in states. The UCC amendments were finalized in 2022. They were first introduced in last session and around certain states. Certain states, there was some concern brought up that these amendments were creating a national digital currency. So what has been added at the ULC's permission, and it will be added to the ULC product as well, is a statement that says there is nothing in this bill that creates a national digital currency. So it's a disclaimer that's been added to make sure everyone's comfortable that nothing was meant, no, this is not meant to do that. All it's meant to do is capture the assets that are already out there, and I'm a lawyer, so I use the word assets, capture what's already out there and what's happening, but not in any way create a currency, identify things as money or what have you. These are out there in commerce. So the Uniform Commercial Code is meant to capture what's in commerce already, not endorse or create or do anything to that effect.
Right, Representative Niska, any follow-up?
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. And no follow-up questions, just a comment, which is thank you for your work on this. Obviously, digital assets are here, whether we pass this or not. This is, I think, a very helpful step in the right direction. And I do appreciate the language that's in there about a national digital currency. I'm not sure it quite goes far enough. I think that is something that we as legislators have to be pretty vigilant about. I'm very concerned about the privacy and invasion of a sort of personal rights aspect of a national digital currency. But, this is an important law, I think. I will skip my presentation on blockchain and Bitcoin and NFTs given the time. But no, in all seriousness, it's this is an important bill, and thank you for your work on it. Thank you, Representative Curran, for your work on it as well.
All right. Representative Curran, any closing comments? Oh, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And he took my question. I'm glad to hear that. And we are watching the national digital currency issue. I have a meeting with the Federal Reserve next week on this issue because they have been looking into it. But I do want to say I'm not a lawyer, and I do know what an asset is. So thank you.
I have noticed, though, the lawyers are not good at keeping their testimony to 2 minutes. All you lobbyists preparing your people to testify, like when she tells you 2 minutes, we mean 2 minutes. Representative Curran, closing comments.
Please vote in support of this bill. Thank you.
All right. Representative Curran renews their motion that House File 3868 be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, if you can... Members, if you can put the bills that we didn't get to, put them in your brown folder so that staff doesn't have to reprint them for anybody. We will recess and come back at 12:15 in this same room. Anna will also send an email out to folks. With that, we're in recess. Let's get rolling so we all have time to eat something today. First, I will call the hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee back to order. We'll pick up where we left off. Representative Curran, you ready?
Yep.
All right. Representative Curran would like to move. So I will move House File 3860 before this committee. We're going to lay this one over. Representative Curran does have a DE1. Would you like to move the DE1?
Yes, so move, Chair. Thank you.
All right. All those in favor of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Motion prevails. The bill is now in the shape you would like. Representative Curran, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much. I know we have a lot on our agenda. I'll keep it brief. So House File 3860 would establish a State Board of Civil Legal Services, and I will turn it over to our testifier to provide details.
All right. Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Curran, members of the committee. My name is Luke Grunman. I'm currently serving as Interim Executive Director at Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. And I don't think anyone on this committee needs a long introduction to what civil legal aid is. We represent thousands of Minnesotans every year. We help families get out of abusive relationships. We help seniors get their money back from fraud and much, much more. This bill is about oversight and accountability. The legislature appropriated significantly more funding to civil legal aid last year. We need to make sure that money is being spent properly. Until now, the Supreme Court was charged with oversight. It did so through a well-functioning advisory committee, but the task now requires more resources. This bill would create a new board. That board is modeled after the Minnesota Board of Public Defense. It has many advantages. It could allow additional staff positions to be hired to help with the oversight. It can create new quality control standards. It could allow better site visits to be conducted and more controls on that. A separate board would be able to better focus on the task of oversight. Civil legal aid has been in this state for 111 years. This new structure could help ensure that it stay in place for many more. So this bill, as I said, is about oversight and accountability. My organization, Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, would be one of those organizations subject to oversight. So you might say, why is Legal Aid advocating for this bill? Well, I'll tell you, we welcome it. Legal Aid, we are proud of our work. We want the opportunity to demonstrate how proud we are of it, and this board would help us do that. So I know the committee has had a lot of testimony already today, and we're on our second part of the session. So I will keep it short, but happy to help the representative answer questions.
And I do procedurally, I had my notes wrong. It was actually the DE2 amendment. So I will move a motion to reconsider the previous motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right. Representative Curran, would you like to amend your motion to move the DE2 amendment?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. That is my amendment to the motion.
Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Thank you. thank you, staff, for catching that. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Not seeing any. We'll move on to member discussion. Members, any representative? Oh, I'll let you have the last word, Representative Scott. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. And I just have a question for the author. What took so long? I'm shocked. I know we don't have one, but we certainly do for public defense. And I've dealt with a lot of folks, a lot of low-income folks who need help, and there's just not sufficient resources or people willing to do it. So thank you for doing this. But anyway, what's the answer?
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Carroll, for your support. This is the first time that this bill has been presented to me in my first term. So as far as what took me so long, I just got here. I would love to give credit to those who've been doing this work for a long time through Chair Becker Finn. And we've been enhancing these things, as we know, year after year, and certainly have seen a push for this. So now it's time to pass it.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Curran. I got a couple questions. One is, or I should say the first one, can you tell me why the current advisory committee, which is seven lawyers and others appointed by the Supreme Court, insufficient?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and Representative. What I would say to that is that the advisory committee has done an excellent job. It really has. The problem is that the Supreme Court has many, many tasks before it. This board would essentially be the same thing as the advisory committee. In fact, you'll notice in the delete everything amendment that the current advisory committee would become the new board as on day one, and then it would allow appointments to replace those members going forward. So there is absolutely nothing about this that is to cast any aspersions on the great work of that committee and the Supreme Court. It's to what it will allow is for that committee to become an independent board, no longer overseen by the Supreme Court, subject to reports to the legislature directly and for that greater enhanced level of oversight.
And I can add, as the person who's chaired this committee and gone through a couple budget cycles, that there's sometimes been some conflicts of interest, in my opinion, regarding, because the Supreme Court only asks for so much, and it's sort of pitting them against asking for their own needs versus asking for the needs of legal aid. And this way, legal aid could put their requests straight to us as legislators instead of having it go through another entity who has their own needs as well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Curran, thank you for that answer. But I do have concerns with it. I've seen this happening more and more in on other boards, Sentencing Guidelines Commission, Post Board, and a few others. With the setup of this board, it appears it's making the board more political. I'm concerned about that. Are you have any concerns on that as well?
Director or Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, and thank you for the question, Representative. We don't believe that it would make it more political. We think that, as you pointed out, there's been some great lawyers who've served on the committee, and we would expect the same thing would be true for a board. And I think the work of the board, as we talked about, would be oversight. Like, the idea is they would help us as legal aides to do better work for our clients, to make sure that we're doing the things that we have promised to do. And so there's not anything inherently political about that. It's just helping us do better quality control for our clients.
Any follow-up, Representative Johnson?
Chair Becker Finn, the testifier. I understand that. But like I said, I have a lot of concerns, because when Post Board and Sentencing Guidelines and a few other boards were set up, it was set up that way. And unfortunately, they've changed dramatically. So I believe it's much better under the Supreme Court, because it seems to work a lot better that way. And so I got a lot of indigestion with this.
Thank you. And I will point out on line 1.19 that the majority of the members of the board would be appointed by the Supreme Court. Next on the list, Representative Grossel.
Well, Madam Chair, in that flurry of exchanges, I think the question was answered that I had. Thank you.
Great. Representative Scott, now you're the last one on the list. Okay.
Thank you. Chair Becker Finn. I guess I don't have a lot of questions that haven't already been answered. I don't have any, as a matter of fact. I just think this is an expansion of government that's not needed. I think what we had was fine. And just because we can doesn't mean we should. So I'll be voting no. Thank you.
All right. And we're not voting on it. We're laying it over.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah.
I'm a little late. Sorry.
Closing comments, Representative Curran.
Yes, thank you, Chair Becker Finn, and thank you all for the discussion. I appreciate the discussion of, you know, looking at government oversight and are we doing too much of that. I will say what I see with this board in particular, it is very different from other boards that have been established that look more at policy decisions. This is primarily focused on looking at how we're using the state's money and gives greater oversight in the use of that money. And so, you know, in that regard, I think that there really is some urgency to this bill to ensure that the board is established prior to any major funding decisions that might be made next session. I think that this board will ensure that funds are used more efficiently than they might be now.
All right. Thank you. With that, I will lay over House File 3860 as amended by the DE2. Next up, I got Representative Feist. Representative Feist, would you like to move to re-refer House File 4157 to the Education Policy Committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All right, the bill is in front of us. Representative Feist, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you. This bill authorizes school districts and charter schools to release specific student data to the Department of Employment and Economic Development for the purposes of coordination of special education services under Section 125A with pre-employment transition services for students with disabilities. And I'll keep this short because we are running over. But basically, when we made certain data private under the registry bill last session, we inadvertently created a disconnect in the Department of Employment and Economic Development would like to make sure that they can reach these students and families and make sure they can provide services. And I will leave it at that.
All right. And I've got one testifier, Megan Ariola. Please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Megan Ariola. I'm the legislative coordinator for the government relations team at the Minnesota Department of Education. I'd like to thank the chair and the committee for giving us time this afternoon to present this bill and to Representative Feist for letting this go through, for authoring this bill so we can come through the committee. This bill is a standalone provision of one standalone provision from the governor's education policy bill. We cloned this provision to just respect the jurisdiction of this committee and ensure that this provision receives its proper review. So the change being requested in Section 13 to the education data provisions of law is to permit our districts to continue assisting our students without being out of compliance with the law. As Representative Feist mentions, this proposal authorizes school districts and charters to release specific student data to DEED for the purposes of coordinating special education services under Section 125A. These services include a number of things for our students that receive special education during their K-12 experience, including job exploration counseling, work-based learning experiences, post-secondary education counseling, workplace readiness training, and instruction in self-advocacy. The purpose is to ensure that students with disabilities receive information about these services offered to them and that they can access them. Before last year's classification of student directory data as private education data, districts with students receiving special education services that were eligible for these programs they've been relaying that information to DEED with no issue in years past, but right now they don't want to be out of compliance with the law. There's no automatic way for DEED to know which students that are graduating or leaving the K-12 system have a disability so that they can reach out and let the students know about their rights under these services. Our MDE student database doesn't include any contact information, so the only way for DEED to be able to provide these services for these kids is to allow schools and school districts to release directory information directly to DEED so that they can contact the family and the student. Without these, they just might not, they could miss deadlines or otherwise be not accessing services that could help them in their career transition. Thank the chair and the rest of the committee for the time to hear the provision, and I stand ready for any questions.
All right. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Not seeing anyone, move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to verify, put it on the record, that this information was already being shared prior to the changes that were made in the directory information last year. We're just, it was either DEED didn't show up or just wasn't aware of that change and how it would affect them. So we're not gathering any new data, sharing any new data. We're just picking up where we left off.
I see lots of nodding heads, but for the record, Ms. Ariola.
Verbal confirmation of yes, Representative Scott. This should allow our districts to continue doing the work they were doing last year.
Any other member discussion? All right. Closing comments, Representative Feist.
This is a good bill. Please support it. Thank you.
All right. Representative Feist renews her motion to refer House File 4157 to the Education Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Feist.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Stevenson, sorry that we're making you miss your lunchtime.
Sorry, not sorry.
I'm the problem, it's me.
I enjoyed my delicious lunch of a granola bar sitting in the gallery.
They're better than me today. Representative Stevenson, I will move to recommend House File 3625 be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. I will note the provision that's in front of why this is in front of us is Section 6 regarding injunctive relief. So if we can keep the discussion and our questions to that provision, why it's in front of us, that would be great. Chair Stevenson, please tell me about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. This is revisions to the deepfake bill that passed with broad support last year and really was a nation-leading piece of legislation designed to put some guardrails in place to protect against the emerging threat of deepfakes in our elections and in sort of sexual abuse situations. The provision that brings this before the committee is the availability of equitable or injunctive relief to clarification in Section 6. It's just making sure that we have the ability to try and stop people from disseminating these deepfakes. And with that, I'm happy to answer questions.
All right. Let's see. I do have a couple testifiers signed up. First up, I have David Fisher, And then I have Terry Nelson on deck. Please introduce yourself and correct your name if you're not David Fisher.
This is Mary Hartnett. I am not David Fisher.
Okay.
But I am with Clean Elections Minnesota. He was not able to.
Okay. Well, I will remind you, as he was reminded, you've got 2 minutes. So please introduce yourself and go ahead.
With Clean Elections Minnesota, a nonpartisan nonprofit working for an inclusive and healthy democracy in Minnesota. We believe that faith in elections and acceptance of results are essential ingredients of a functional democracy. Even now, deepfake AI is turning our U.S. presidential election to a test on the need to prevent the harms of deceptive content in our media. Early this year, thousands of fake robocalls went out for the New Hampshire primary, discouraging people from voting. While robocalls are not new, making a persuasive hoax has gotten easier, faster, and cheaper thanks to generative AI tools. HF 3625 addresses head-on the need to mitigate the pernicious nature of such fraud during the media run-up to an election the last 60 days when there's little time to fact-check or debunk it by adding additional consequences for violations of the law. We thank this committee and the legislature for their bipartisan work on this issue and urge support for the additional provisions that will strengthen last year's bipartisan bill. And thank you for your work, and thank you for giving the opportunity to testify.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Terry Nelson. Please introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Teresa Nelson, and I'm legal director for the ACLU of Minnesota. I have over 2 decades of experience litigating constitutional rights issues, and I'm an adjunct law professor. So first, 3 quick, important First Amendment law concepts. 1, except in limited circumstances, parody and false speech, including false political speech, is protected by the First Amendment. 2, under New York Times v. Sullivan, false statements about public officials and public figures can be punished, including getting injunctive relief, but only if the speech is made with knowledge that the speech is false or with a high degree of awareness of probable falsity. That standard is higher than the reasonably should know standard in 609.771, which is a negligence standard. And 3, content-based restrictions on speech must pass strict scrutiny. The government must have a compelling interest, and the restrictions must not burden more speech than necessary to serve that compelling interest. Now, the underlying statute here is on shaky First Amendment grounds because it has to pass strict scrutiny, and it is too broad because it criminalizes more speech than necessary to serve the government's interest here. House Bill 3625 doubles down and makes it even more broad by expanding the timeframes for which when speech can be criminalized, expanding the penalties, and even more problematic, expanding the content of the speech that can be criminalized. The language starting on line 2.25 essentially criminalizes material that is capable of multiple interpretations. Negligently retweeting a poorly executed parody will become a crime. And that speech doesn't even have to be false. One could graft a video of a candidate speaking using the candidate's actual words taken from other source material, and that would be a crime even though the underlying information is accurate. And so the new language also passes, raises due process concerns because it's vague. It doesn't give adequate notice to people about what speech is going to land them in jail. We already have tools in statute to address intentionally false campaign speech. And to be clear, the ACLU does not oppose narrowly drawn prohibitions on, for example, intentionally false misleading speech about the time, place, manner, or legal consequences of voting that is uttered for the purpose of disenfranchising voters. And so because of the breadth of House Bill 3625, we respectfully urge you to reject this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion, but we'll remind members that we're talking about whether we should add or equitable in the injunctive relief section starting on line 4.7. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and Representative Stevenson. I will be brief because my comments, I think, go more towards the constitutional issues about this, which I do think are reasonably within the discussion of this, but just very briefly, I agree with some of the comments the ACLU testifier made, in particular about the new language on 2.25. I do think that can be tightened up. I hope you all look into ways to tighten that up for sure. But my question for you is, how does this interact with the constitutional provisions that define the eligibility for members of the legislature or define the members of the executive branch? when we're talking about disqualifying people from office. And, you know, for example, the legislative provision says the legislature shall, it lists certain qualifications. It doesn't allow the legislature to add to them, and it says the legislature will be the judge of its members' qualifications. So how would this provision work with that provision of the Minnesota Constitution?
Representative Niska, you went outside Section 6, but I'll allow it. If Representative Stevenson, you can keep it short and we don't continue down this path. Representative Stevenson.
Section 2 relates to disqualified candidates not to hold certain positions. It's important to note that this pertains only to state and local positions, not federal positions, which we can't do for federal constitutional reasons. There are existing law disqualifying candidates who break certain laws from holding office in Minnesota that I believe is statutory and not constitutional. I'm not aware if it's been litigated at the Supreme Court of that existing prohibition. This simply adds deepfakes to that. So there's already violations of the, what I think is called the Fair Campaign Practices Act, is already potentially a disqualifier for state and local office under Minnesota law, and this adds the deepfake provision to that. So I believe it's on square constitutional ground in with regard to the Minnesota Constitution, but it's worth noting that perhaps that underlying provision may or may not have been constitutionally litigated in Minnesota.
Representative Niska, any follow-up?
I will just say I hope we can continue to have this conversation. The way I read Article 4, Section 6, it does seem like it's a potential problem in terms of dealing with legislators. Overarching issue, obviously, this is an extremely important issue. The technology that we're talking about, the potential to really deceive voters, is a real issue. And so, as we discussed last term, I appreciate the fact that you're taking it on, and I appreciate the willingness you had last session to talk, dig into the language and talk about it. And I hope that will continue. I don't think this is quite ready yet. Thank you.
On caucus night, my kid described my job as running from room to room talking to people. And I know that Representative Stevenson is very good at that. So I'm sure conversations will continue. Any further discussion to the bill? All right. Closing comments, Representative Stevenson.
It's a good bill. A good bill. Please vote yes.
All right. I will renew my motion to recommend that House File 3625 be referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. You still get to sit up there, Representative Stevenson, and you still get to talk with Representative Niska, I bet. I will move House File 3506 before the committee. I understand there is I'm going to double check now since my notes were wrong last time. The A2 is a technical amendment that the author would like, just making some small language tweaks. So I will move the A2. All those in favor of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is in the shape the author would like. Representative Stevenson, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll start by saying that the House research summary, they're always good. This one is particularly good. And so in lieu of going through the bill in detail, I just encourage everyone to lay eyes on that, because I think it does a good job of explaining the various provisions of the bill. This has to do with how a plaintiff's damages are apportioned and calculated in the event of a judgment in a civil action. It modifies some law that was passed a couple decades ago. And I think that law in the subsequent time has been subject to judicial interpretation that has resulted in some unintended consequences that are materially impacting people who have been harmed in Minnesota. The principle behind the change that we made a couple decades ago to law was people should pay for what they broke, right? That we wanted comparative fault and looking at people just paying for the portion of their damages that they are responsible for. Unfortunately, the way that it has been interpreted and applied in the intervening decades have resulted in a case where people are not getting their harms fully addressed, and that is a problem. And so this bill makes some relatively modest changes to that regime, keeping in place. We're not trying to go back to where we were before 2003, but we're going to try and make some changes to make sure that if somebody is hurt, that they have the ability to recover for their damages.
All right, and I do have a couple testifiers signed up. First, I have Chuck Slain, and then I have Dale Thorns-Joe on deck. And the reason I tell you you're on deck is so that you can move closer to the table so you can start your testimony sooner. please introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, and thank you for allowing me to be here and speak today. My name is Chuck Slane. I'm the immediate past president of the Minnesota Association for Justice. As Representative Stevenson said, this bill provides some modest changes to correct some inequities in a law that was changed without any committee involvement at all the last time this was changed. And we'd urge you to pass the bill, and I am available to answer any questions that anyone has that they'd like to discuss.
All right, thank you. Only other person signed up ahead of time, I have Dale Thorns, Joe, and we did allow you can come on up to the table. And I understand you're testifying on behalf of several different people and organizations, so we did allow a little bit longer for your testimony. I appreciate when people coordinate like that. It's easier on everybody that way. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, members of the committee. My name is Dale Thorns, Joe. I am a litigator, civil litigator, in the southwest suburbs of the Twin Cities, and I've been a past chair of a national defense organization, so I've had a wonderful opportunity to coordinate with a lot of lawyers, a lot of jurisdictions, about comparative fault statutes within their jurisdiction. I find it interesting to, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself as an individual, with concurrence from the Insurance Federation, as well as the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association. I find it really interesting that the presentations so far do not talk about the sea change that this bill will have by creating a liability for a defendant who is less at fault than the plaintiff to be obligated to pay part of that judgment. Minnesota has never, ever had a defendant who is less at fault than a plaintiff pay part of a judgment. And the sea change that happens is the use of the word aggregate, which is now changed to combined. Aggregates in the Iowa statute, Ohio has the combined word. But what it really does is that it creates pure comparative fault, which means the plaintiff can be more at fault than an individual defendant and yet have to pay the portion of the fault that's allocated to them. If it's 50-50, like it was in the Staub case, which is the case that the presenters were talking about previously, under the Minnesota statute, that's 50-50. So the defendant pays 50%. But what if the plaintiff is 40% at fault and the two defendants are each 30% at fault? It has always been the law in Minnesota that the plaintiff not recover anything. This statutory change now allows the plaintiff to recover 60% of their damages, even though none of the defendants were more at fault than the plaintiff. That's not been talked about here. This is a massive sea change. This is bad public policy. I try to be good with what I do, and if a plaintiff ends up suing me, but the plaintiff is more at fault than me, why is it that by happenstance, if another party over whom I have no control might be involved in that same lawsuit, and my liability turns not on my conduct, but turns on the conduct of the other person? I have no ability to be able to deal with that person or protect myself from that person. So there's a fundamental unfairness with that term aggregation with the one section. The concept of pure comparative fault is incredibly dangerous. I've talked to jurisprudence people in multiple states that have pure comparative fault, and they basically say their tort system is broken. There is never a discussion of liability ever anymore. It's always about how much can you extricate from the defendant in order to get out of the lawsuit. And that takes away the liability defense that has been the traditional bedrock of the Minnesota tort system. It's interesting because one of the things that the MAJ had talked to me about was there's 22 jurisdictions that allow this aggregation of fault, So in other words, my 40-30-30 example, if you aggregate that, that's 60%. What they don't tell you, and what they didn't tell me, but I learned from talking to dozens of litigators in the jurisdictions, in a lot of these 22 that they mentioned, is that their comparative fault structure is very complicated. And if you change one piece of it, everything else falls apart. If I can have 30 seconds.
Really quick, because we will also be laying this over, so okay. There'll be plenty of other time for you to talk off the record. But just
Here's some points.
One sentence.
There's a differentiation in how other jurisdictions handle the type of damages, the moral culpabilities, whether or not punitive damages are part of the litigation. And so there's a lot of other pieces where the changes proposed in this bill should be part of a comprehensive review and analysis as opposed to a piecemeal approach on revising this statute.
All right. When staff tells you a number of minutes, I actually time myself at home, so I know how long it's going to take me. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify? All right. Not seeing any, I want to make sure we have time for the amendments. I understand the A1 amendment. Representative Niska, is that your amendment?
Yes.
All right. Would you like to move the A1 before us?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. I move the A1 amendment, and in this discussion, I actually would appreciate if both of the attorneys, both of the testifiers, would answer the question for me of what happens under Section 2 and Section 4 together. If a jury finds a driver who's a plaintiff 25% at fault, the other driver who's drunk 70% at fault, and 5% awards 5% fault to the dram shop, to the server, and the 70% at fault driver is uncollectible, because I'm concerned, and this is the reason for the A1 amendment, that in that situation, the 5% at fault, bar under dram shop liability is going to get reallocated a very significant piece of their liability. So if either Mr. Slane or Mr. Thornzio could answer that question. Is that how the law works? Is my concern correct?
Everybody loves a word problem not written down in front of them. But Mr. Slane, please go ahead.
Thank you. And thank you for the question, because I think it's a very important point to understand how the entire process works. First step in that equation is that BAR pays 5%. They pay for their fair share. They pay for what they broke. The law then, and this was the law pre-1983 change, that if an amount is uncollectible, it then gets reallocated fairly amongst everyone, including the plaintiff. A plaintiff who is at fault still has to take their fair share of that uncollectible amount. So they're being treated the same as that defendant who caused the injury to the plaintiff. So still, everybody pays their fair share, and most importantly, that's a special circumstance that happens very rarely, and that's why we have this provision that's been in the bill for decades until the Supreme Court in Staub obliterated it and left it meaningless, and that's why it's important to give it meaning once more.
Please go ahead as quickly as you can.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Representative Niska, very important question. Why should I be 5% liable when the plaintiff is more at fault? That 5% liability has never paid ever in the history of what's going on. Even more importantly, this legislation in an employer as a third-party defendant, for example, so an employee gets injured, sues a product manufacturer or sues a third-party tortfeasor, who then brings in the employer, say they didn't properly supervise, they didn't properly train, this sort of thing. So now you have a situation where it's 25% plaintiff, 5% tortfeasor, and 75% employer. Under a case called Fish, as applied to this aggregate combined section, means the 5% defendant pays the entirety of the employer's liability. In other words, they pay 80%, even though they're only 5% at fault. So they've never had to pay it before, and under this provision, they will pay 80%. That's just simply not fair under Minnesota jurisprudence.
All right, any other discussion to the A1 amendment? Representative Niska, closing comment.
Yes, thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. And if I understood your answer, Mr. Slain, I think what that means is that the 5% at fault bar gets allocated that 70% at a 1-to-5 ratio with the plaintiff, which is another 11.6%. So the 5% bar, 5% liable bar, ends up with over 15% liability. And so, frankly, I don't think that is people paying for what they broke. I think that is people paying more than what they broke, and that's why I think that 2 and 4 aren't ready yet. It doesn't strike the right balance. I urge members to vote yes, and I request a roll call.
Roll call having been requested. Representative Stevenson, any comments?
I'd ask members to vote no. And I'd just point out, when Representative Niska was doing the math there, he left off the other half of the equation, which is that the balance of that 70% that's being reallocated is reallocated to the plaintiff. And so he's concerned about the dram shop going from 5 to 11, but the plaintiff goes from 20 to, I'm not doing the math, but a much, much, much higher number. And so I think what we have to think about in this situation, when an amount is uncollectible, it's not that that harm goes away. It's not that those dollars evaporate into thin air. Somebody is eating the cost of it. And under the current system, that's entirely, all of that burden falls on the injured person, nothing on the rest of the party. That's not fair. If the idea is pay for what you broke, pay for it in proportion. And in a situation where something is collectible, reassigning it equitably is the right solution.
All right. The A1 amendment before us, a roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier.
No.
Lead Scott.
Yes.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Feist.
No.
Representative Peeney. No. Representative Frederick.
No.
Representative Grossel. Representative Johnson.
No. Or yes.
Representative Mueller.
No.
Representative Niska.
Yes.
Representative Weens. 3 ayes, 8 nays.
All right, the motion does not prevail. I'm not going to piss off the tax chair. So when we pick this bill up again, the A4 will still be valid. We're not going to reopen the whole window on amendments necessarily, but you will get your shot to make that argument in the future when we pick the bill back up, Representative Niska.
Any sense on when that might be?
Not at all. I may depend on some conversations that are happening, but it will be noticed the same as we notice everything else in this committee. With that, I will lay over House File 3506, and with that, we are adjourned.